harm befalls her. His cold blue eyes finished the promise. Simeon snatched one of the candles and scurried into the hallway, still bowing so the candlelight made their shadows dance.
This way, good mistress, this way.
Beyond the door at the end of the hall, outside stairs led down to a cramped alleyway between inn and stable. Night shrank the candle to a flickering pinpoint. The half-moon was up in a star-flecked sky, giving more than enough light for Perrin's eyes. He wondered when Moraine would tell Simeon he did not have to keep bowing, but she never did. The Aes Sedai glided along, clutching her skirts to keep them out of the mud, as though the dark passage were a palace hall and she a queen. The air was already cooling. Nights still carried echoes of winter.
This way.
Simeon led them back to a small shed behind the stable and hurriedly unbarred the door.
This way,
Simeon pointed.
There, good mistress, there. My brother Gnome.
The far end of the shed had been barred off with slats of wood, hastily by the rough look of it. A stout iron lock and a hasp held shut a crude door of wooden slats. Behind those bars, a man lay sprawled on his stomach on the straw-covered floor. He was barefoot, his shirt and breeches ripped as if he had torn at them without knowing how to take them off. There was an odor of unwashed flesh that Perrin thought even Simeon and Moraine must smell. Gnome lifted his head and stared at them silently, without expression. There was nothing at all about him to suggest he was Simeon's brother. He had a chin, for one thing, and he was a big man with heavy shoulders. But that was not what staggered Perrin. Gnome stared at them with burnished, golden eyes.
He'd been talking crazy almost a year, good mistress, saying he could talk with wolves. And his eyes.
Simeon darted a glance at Perrin.
Well, he'd talk about it when he'd drunk too much. Everybody laughed at him. Then a month or so ago, he didn't come to town. I went out to see what was the matter, and I found him. Like this.
Cautiously, unwillingly, Perrin reached out toward Gnome as he would have toward a wolf. Running through the woods with the cold wind in his nose. Quick dash for cover, teeth snapping at hamstrings. Taste of blood, rich on the tongue. Kill! Perrin jerked back, as he would have from a fire. Sealed himself off. They were not thoughts at all, really. Just a chaotic jumble of desires and images, part memory, part yearning. But there was more wolf there than anything else. He put a hand to the wall to steady himself. His knees felt weak.
Light, help me.
Moraine put a hand on the lock.
Master Herod has the key, good mistress. I don't know if he'll...
She gave a tug, and the lock sprang open. Simeon gaped at her. She lifted the lock free of the hasp, and the chinless man turned to Perrin.
Is that safe, good master? He's my brother, but he bit Mother Rune when she tried to help, and he killed a cow. With his teeth.
He finished faintly. Moraine, Perrin said, the man is dangerous.
All men are dangerous, she replied in a cool voice. Now be quiet.
She opened the door and went in. Perrin held his breath. At her first step, Gnome's lips peeled back from his teeth and he began to growl. A rumble that deepened till his whole body quivered. Moraine ignored it. Still growling, Gnome wriggled backwards in the straw as she came closer to him until he had backed himself into a corner. Or she had backed him. Slowly, calmly, the Aes Sedai knelt and took his head between her hands. Gnome's growl heightened to a snarl, then tailed off in a whimper before Perrin could move. For a long moment, Moraine held Gnome's head, then just as calmly released it and rose. Perrin's throat tightened as she turned her back on Gnome and walked out of the cage, but the man only stared after her. She pushed the slatted door to, slipped the lock back through the hasp, not bothering to snap it shut. And Gnome hurled himself snarling against the wooden bars. He bit at them and battered them with his shoulders, trying to force his head between them, all the while snarling and snapping. Moraine brushed straw from her skirt with a steady hand and no expression.
You do take chances, Perrin breathed.
She looked at him, a steady, knowing gaze, and he dropped his eyes. His yellow eyes. Simeon was staring at his brother.
Can you help him, good mistress?
He asked hoarsely.
I am sorry, Simeon, she said.
Can't you do anything, good mistress? Something? One of those?
His voice fell to a whisper.
I said I things.
Healing is not a simple matter, Simeon, and it comes from within as much as from the healer. There is nothing here that remembers being gnome, nothing that remembers being a man. There are no maps remaining to show him the path back, and nothing left to take that path. Gnome is gone, Simeon.
He just used to talk funny, good mistress. When he'd had too much to drink, he just...
Simeon scrubbed a hand across his eyes and blinked.
Thank you, good mistress. I know you'd have done something if you could.
She put a hand on his shoulder, murmured comforting words, and then she was gone from the shed. Perrin knew he should follow her, but the man, what had once been a man, snapping at the wooden bars, held him. He took a quick step and surprised himself by removing the dangling lock from the hasp. The lock was a good one, the work of a master smith.
Good master?
Perrin stared at the lock in his hand, at the man behind in the cage. Gnome had stopped biting at the slats. He stared back at Perrin warily, panting. Some of his teeth had broken off jaggedly. You can leave him in here forever, Perrin said. But I don't think he'll ever get any better.
If he gets out, good master, he'll die.
He will die in here or out there, Simeon. Out there, at least, he'll be free and as happy as he can be. He is not your brother anymore, but you're the one who has to decide. You can leave him in here for people to stare at, leave him to stare at the bars of his cage until he pines away. You cannot cage a wolf, Simeon, not and expect it to be happy, or live long.
Yes, Simeon said slowly. Yes, I see.
He hesitated, then nodded, and jerked his head toward the shed door. That was all the answer Perrin needed. He swung back the slatted door and stood aside. For a moment, Gnome stared at the opening. Abruptly, he darted out of the cage, running on all fours, but with surprising agility. Out of the cage, out of the shed, and into the night.
The light help us both, Perrin thought. I suppose it's better for him to be free.
Simeon gave himself a shake.
But I don't know what Master Herod will say when he finds that door standing open and Gnome gone.
Perrin shut the cage door. The big lock made a sharp click as he refastened it. Let him puzzle that out. Simeon barked a quick laugh, abruptly cut off.
He'll make something out of it. They all will. Some of them say Gnome turned into a wolf, fur and all, when he bit Mother Rune. It's not true, but they say it.
Shivering, Perrin leaned his head against the cage door.
He may not have fur, but he is a wolf. He is a wolf, not a man. Light help me. We didn't keep him here always, Simeon said suddenly. He was at Mother Rune's house, but she and I got Master Herod to move him here after the White Cloaks came. They always have a list of names. Dark friends they're looking for. It was Gnome's eyes, you see. One of the names the White Cloaks had was a fellow named Perrin Ibarra, a blacksmith. They said he has yellow eyes and runs with wolves. You see why I didn't want them to know about Gnome.
Perrin turned his head enough to look at Simeon over his shoulder. Do you think this Perrin Ibarra is a dark friend?
A dark friend wouldn't care if my brother died in a cage. I suppose she found you soon after it happened, in time to help. I wish she'd come to Jara a few months ago.
Perrin was ashamed that he had ever compared the man to a frog. And I wish she could have done something for him.
Burn me, I wish she could.
Suddenly it burst on him that the whole village must know about Gnome, about his eyes.
Simeon, would you bring me something to eat in my room?
Master Herod and the rest might have been too taken with staring at Loyal to notice his eyes before, but they surely would if he ate in the common room.
Of course, and in the morning too. You don't have to come down until you're ready to get on your horse.
You are a good man, Simeon. A good man.
Simeon looked so pleased that Perrin felt ashamed all over again.
Chapter 9. Wolf Dreams.
Perrin returned to his room by the back way, and after a time Simeon came up with a covered tray. The cloth did not hold in the smells of roasted mutton, sweet beans, turnips, and freshly baked bread, but Perrin lay on his bed staring at the whitewashed ceiling until the aromas grew cold. Images of Gnome ran through his head over and over again. Gnome chewing at the wooden slats. Gnome running off into the darkness. He tried to think of lockmaking, of the careful quenching and shaping of the steel. But it did not work. Ignoring the tray, he rose and made his way down the hall to Moraine's room. She answered his rap on the door with, "Come in, Perrin." For an instant, all the old stories about Aes Sedai stirred again, but he pushed them aside and opened the door. Moraine was alone, for which he was grateful, sitting with an ink bottle balanced on her knee, writing in a small leather-bound book. She corked the bottle and wiped the steel nib of her pen on a small scrap of parchment without looking at him. There was a fire in the fireplace.
"I have been expecting you for some time," she said. "I have not spoken about this before because it was obvious you did not want me to. After tonight, though, what do you want to know?"
"Is that what I can expect?" he asked. "To end like that?"
"Perhaps."
He waited for more, but she only put pen and ink away in their small case of polished rosewood and blew on her writing to dry it.
"Is that all? Moraine, don't give me slippery Aes Sedai answers. If you know something, tell me, please."
"I know very little, Perrin."
While searching for other answers among the books and manuscripts two friends keep for their researches, I found a copied fragment of a book from the Age of Legends. It spoke of situations like yours. That may be the only copy anywhere in the world, and it did not tell me much.
"What did it tell you? Anything at all is more than I know. Burn me, I've been worrying about Rand going mad, but I never thought I had to worry about myself."
"Perrin, even in the Age of Legends, they knew little of this. Whoever wrote it seemed uncertain whether it was truth or legend, and I only saw a fragment, remember. She said that some who talked to wolves lost themselves, that what was human was swallowed up by wolf. Some. Whether she meant 1 in 10, or 5, or 9, I do not know."
"I can shut them out. I don't know how I do it, but I can refuse to listen to them. I can refuse to hear them. Will that help?"
"It may." She studied him, seeming to choose her words carefully. "Mostly she wrote of dreams. Dreams can be dangerous for you, Perrin."
"You said that once before. What do you mean?"
"According to her, wolves live partly in this world and partly in a world of dreams."
"A world of dreams?" he said disbelievingly.
Moraine gave him a sharp look.
"That is what I said, and that is what she wrote. The way wolves talk to one another, the way they talk to you, is in some way connected to this world of dreams. I do not claim to understand how."
She paused, frowning slightly.
"From what I have read of the Aes Sedai who had the talent called dreaming, dreamers sometimes spoke of encountering wolves in their dreams, even wolves that acted as guides. I fear you must learn to be as careful sleeping as waking, if you intend to avoid wolves."
"If that is what you decide to do."
"If that is what I decide, Moraine, I will not end up like Gnome, I won't."
She eyed him quizzically, shaking her head slowly.
"You speak as if you can make all your own choices, Perrin. You are Taviren, remember?"
He turned his back on her, staring at the night-dark windows, but she continued.
"Perhaps knowing what Rand is, knowing how strongly Taviren he is, I have paid too little attention to the other two Taviren I found with him. 3 Taviren in the same village, all born within weeks of one another. That is unheard of. Perhaps you and Matt have larger purposes in the pattern than you or I thought."
"I do not want any purpose in the pattern," Perrin muttered. "I surely can't have one if I forget I am a man."
"Will you help me, Moraine?"
It was hard to say that.
What if it means her using the one power? Would I rather forget I'm a man?
Help me keep from losing myself.
If I can keep you whole, I will. I promise you that, Perrin. But I will not endanger the struggle against the shadow. You must know that, too.
When he turned to look at her, she was regarding him unblinkingly.
And if your struggle means putting me in my grave tomorrow, will you do that, too?
He was icily sure that she would.
What have you not told me?
Do not presume too far, Perrin, she said coldly.
Do not press me further than I think proper.
He hesitated before asking the next question.
Can you do for me what you did for Lan? Can you shield my dreams?
I already have a warder, Perrin.
Her lips quirked almost into a smile. And one is all I will have. I am of the blue, Aja, not the green.
You know what I mean. I don't want to be a warder.
Light, bound to an Aes Sedai the rest of my life. That's as bad as the wolves.
It would not aid you, Perrin. The shielding is for dreams from the outside. The danger in your dreams is within you. She opened the small book again.
You should sleep, she said in dismissal. Be wary of your dreams, but you must sleep sometime.
She turned a page and he left. Back in his own room, he eased the hold he kept on himself, eased it just a trifle, let his senses spread. The wolves were out there still, beyond the edges of the village, ringing Jara. Almost immediately, he snapped back to rigid self-control.
What I need is a city, he muttered.
That would keep them at bay.
After I find Rand. After I finish whatever has to be finished with him.
He was not sure how sorry he was that Moraine could not shield him. The one power or the wolves, that was a choice no man should have to make. He left the fire laid and the hearthstone unlit and threw open both windows. Cold night air rushed in. Tossing blankets and comforter on the floor, he lay down fully clothed on the lumpy bed, not bothering to try to find a comfortable position. His last thought before sleep came was that if anything would keep him from deep sleep and dangerous dreams, that mattress would. He was in a long hallway, its high stone ceiling and walls glistening with damp and streaked by odd shadows. They lay in contorted strips, stopping as abruptly as they began, too dark for the light between them. He had no idea where the light came from.
No, he said.
Then louder,
no, this is a dream. I need to wake up. Wake up.
The hallway did not change.
Danger.
It was a wolf's thought, faint and distant.
I will wake up. I will.
He pounded a fist against the wall. It hurt, but he did not wake. He thought one of the sinuous shadows shifted away from his blow.
Run, brother, run. Hopper? He said wonderingly.
He was sure he knew the wolf whose thoughts he heard. Hopper, who had envied the eagles.
Hopper is dead. Run!
Perrin lurched into a run, one hand holding his axe to keep the haft from banging against his leg. He had no idea where he was running or why, but the urgency of Hopper's sending could not be ignored.
Hopper's dead, he thought.
He's dead.
But Perrin ran. Other hallways crossed the one he ran along, at odd angles, sometimes descending, sometimes climbing. None looked any different from the passage he was in, though. Damp stone walls unbroken by doors and strips of darkness. As he came on one of those crossing halls, he skidded to a halt. A man stood there, blinking at him uncertainly, in strangely cut coat and breeches, the coat flaring over his hips as the bottoms of the breeches flared over his boots. Both were bright yellow, and his boots were only a little paler.
This is more than I can stand,
the man said, to himself, not Perrin. He had an odd accent, quick and sharp.
Not only do I dream of peasants now, but foreign peasants from those clothes. Be gone from my dreams, fellow.
Who are you?
Perrin asked. The man's eyebrows rose as if he were offended. The strips of shadow around them writhed. One detached from the ceiling at one end and drifted down to touch the strange man's head. It appeared to tangle in his hair. The man's eyes widened, and everything seemed to happen at once. The shadow jerked back to the ceiling, 10 feet overhead, trailing something pale. Wet drops splattered Perrin's face. A bone-rattling shriek shattered the air. Frozen, Perrin stared at the bloody shape wearing the man's clothes, screaming and thrashing on the floor. Unbidden, his eyes rose to the pale thing like an empty sack that dangled from the ceiling. Part of it was already absorbed by the black strip, but he had no trouble recognizing a human skin, apparently whole and unbroken. The shadows around him danced in agitation, and Perrin ran, pursued by dying screams. Ripples ran along the shadow strips, pacing him. "Change, burn you!" he shouted. "I know it's a dream! Light, burn you, change!" Colorful tapestries hung along the walls between tall golden stands holding dozens of candles that illuminated white floor tiles, and a ceiling painted with fluffy clouds and fanciful birds in flight. Nothing moved but the flickering candle flames along the length of that hall, stretching as far as he could see, or in the pointed arches of white stone that occasionally broke the walls.
Danger.
The sending was even fainter than before, and more urgent if that were possible. Axe in hand, Perrin started warily down the hall, muttering to himself.
"Wake up. Wake up, Perrin. If you know it's a dream, it changes, or you wake up. Wake up, burn you!"
The hallway stayed as solid as any he had ever walked. He came abreast of the first of the pointed white archways. It led into a huge room, apparently windowless, but furnished as ornately as any palace, the furniture all carved and gilded and inlaid with ivory. A woman stood in the middle of the room, frowning at a tattered manuscript lying open on a table. A black-haired, black-eyed, beautiful woman clothed in white and silver. Even as he recognized her, she lifted her head and looked straight at him. Her eyes widened in shock, in anger.
"You? What are you doing here? How did you? You'll ruin things you cannot begin to imagine."
Abruptly, the space seemed to flatten, as if he were suddenly staring at a picture of a room. The flat image appeared to turn sideways, become only a bright vertical line down the middle of blackness. The line flashed white and was gone, leaving only the dark, blacker than black. Just in front of Perrin's boots, the floor tiles came to an abrupt end. As he watched, the white edges dissolved into the black like sand washed away by water. He stepped back hastily.
"Run!"
Perrin turned and Hopper was there, a big gray wolf, grizzled and scarred.
"You are dead. I saw you die. I felt you die."
Ascending flooded Perrin's mind.
"Run now. You must not be here now. Danger, great danger. Worse than all the Neverborn. You must go, go now, now."
"How?"
Perrin shouted.
"I want to go, but how?"
"Go!"
Teeth bared, Hopper leaped for Perrin's throat. With a strangled cry, Perrin sat up on the bed, hands going to his throat to hold in lifeblood. They met unbroken skin. He swallowed with relief, but the next moment his fingers touched a damp spot. Almost falling in his haste, he scrambled off the bed, stumbled to the washstand, and seized the pitcher, splashed water everywhere as he filled the basin. The water turned pink as he washed his face. Pink with the blood of that strangely dressed man. More dark spots dotted his coat and breeches. He tore them off and tossed them into the furthest corner. He meant to leave them there. Simeon could burn them. A gust of wind whipped in the open window. Shivering in shirt and small clothes, he sat on the floor and leaned back against the bed.
This should be uncomfortable enough.
Sourness tinged his thoughts, and worry and fear. And determination.
I won't give in to this. I won't.
He was still shivering when sleep finally came. A shallow half-sleep filled with vague awareness of the room around him and thoughts of the cold. But the bad dreams that came were better than some others. Rand huddled under the trees in the night, watching the heavy-shouldered black dog come nearer his hiding place. His side ached. The wound Moraine could not quite heal, but he ignored it. The moon gave barely enough light for him to make out the dog, waist high with its thick neck and massive head, and its teeth that seemed to shine like wet silver in the night. It sniffed the air and trotted toward him.
Closer, he thought. Come closer. No warning for your master this time. Closer. That's it.
The dog was only 10 paces away now, a deep growl rumbling in its chest as it suddenly bounded forward. Straight it ran. The power filled him. Something leaped from his outstretched hands. He was not sure what it was. A bar of white light, solid as steel. Liquid fire. For an instant, in the middle of that something, the dog seemed to become transparent. And then it was gone. The white light faded except for the afterimage burned across Rand's vision. He sagged against the nearest tree trunk, the bark rough on his face. Relief and silent laughter shook him.
It worked. Light save me, it worked this time.
It had not always. There had been other dogs this night. The one power pulsed in him, and his stomach, twisted with the Dark One's taint on Sidene, wanted to empty itself. Sweat beaded on his face despite the cold night wind, and his mouth tasted full of sickness. He wanted to lie down and die. He wanted Nynaeve to give him some of her medicines, or Moraine to heal him, or something, anything to stop the sick feeling that was suffocating him. But Sidene flooded him with life, too. Life and energy and awareness larded through the illness. Life without Sidene was a pale copy. Anything else was a wan imitation.
But they can find me if I hold on. Track me, find me. I have to reach Tyr. I'll find out there. If I am the dragon, there'll be an end to it. And if I am not, if it's all a lie, there will be an end to that too. An end.
Reluctantly, with infinite slowness, he severed contact with Sidene. Gave up its embrace as if giving up life's breath. The night seemed drab. The shadows lost their infinite sharp shadings and washed together. In the distance, to the west, a dog howled, a shivering cry in the silent night. Rand's head came up. He peered in that direction, as though he could see the dog if he tried hard enough. A second dog answered the first, then another, and two more together, all spread out somewhere west of him.
Hunt me, Rand snarled. Hunt me if you will. I'm no easy meat. No more.
Pushing himself away from the tree, he waded a shallow, icy stream, then settled into a steady trot eastward. Cold water filled his boots, and his side hurt, but he ignored both. The night was quiet again behind him, but he ignored that too.
Hunt me. I can hunt too. I am no easy meat.
Chapter 10. Secrets. Ignoring her companions for a moment, Egwene Alvear stood in her stirrups, hoping for a glimpse of Tar Valon in the distance, but all she could see was something indistinct, gleaming white in the morning sunlight. It had to be the city on the island, though. The lone, broken-topped mountain called Dragon Mount, rising out of the rolling plain, had first appeared on the horizon late the afternoon before, and that lay just this side of the River Arinon from Tar Valon. It was a landmark, that mountain, one jagged fang sticking up out of rolling flatlands, easily seen for many miles, easy to avoid, as all did, even those who went to Tar Valon. Dragon Mount was where Luz Theron Kinslayer had died, so it was said, and other words had been spoken of the mountain, prophecy and warning, rich reasons to stay away from its black slopes. She had reason not to stay away, and more than one. Only in Tar Valon could she find the training she needed, the training she had to have. I will never be collared again. She pushed the thought away, but it came back turned end about. I will never lose my freedom again. In Tar Valon, Anaya would resume testing her dreams. The Aes Sedai would have to, though she had found no real evidence that Egwene was a dreamer, as Anaya suspected. Egwene's dreams had been troubling since leaving Almuth Plain. Aside from dreams of the Shan Chan, and those still made her wake sweating, she dreamed more and more of Rand. Rand running. running towards something but running away from something too. She peered harder toward Tar Valon. Anaya would be there. And Galad too, perhaps. She blushed in spite of herself and banished him from her mind entirely. Think about the weather. Think about anything else. Light, but it feels warm. This early in the year, with winter only yesterday's memory, White still capped Dragon Mount, but here below the snows were melted. Early shoots poked through the matted brown of last year's grasses, and where trees topped a low hill here and there, the first red of new growth was showing. After a winter spent traveling, sometimes trapped in village or camp for days by storms, sometimes covering less ground between sunrise and sunset, with snowdrifts belly-deep on the horses, than she could have walked by noon in better weather, it was good to see signs of spring. Sweeping her thick wool cloak back out of her way, Egwene let herself drop down in the high-cantled saddle and smoothed her skirts in a gesture of impatience. Her dark eyes filled with distaste. She had worn the dress, divided for riding by her own skill with a needle, for far too long, but the only other she had was even more grubby. And the same color, the dark gray of the leashed ones. The choice all those weeks ago on beginning their ride to Tar Valon had been dark gray or nothing. "I swear I will never wear gray again, Bella," she told her shaggy mount, patting the mare's neck. "Not that I'll have much choice once we're back in the White Tower," she thought. In the Tower, all novices wore white. "Are you talking to yourself again?" Nynaeve asked, pulling her bay gelding closer. The two women were of a height as well as dressed alike, but the difference in their horses put the former Wisdom of Emmons Field a head taller. Nynaeve frowned now and tugged at the thick braid of dark hair hanging over her shoulder, the way she did when worried or troubled, or sometimes when she was preparing to be particularly stubborn, even for her. A great serpent ring on her finger marked her as one of the accepted, not yet Aes Sedai, but a long step closer than Egwene. "Better you should be keeping watch." Egwene held her tongue on the retort that she had been watching for Tar Valon. "Did she think I was standing in my stirrups because I do not like my saddle?" Nynaeve seemed to forget too often that she was not the Wisdom of Emmons Field any longer, and Egwene was no longer a child. "But she wears the ring, and I do not, yet, and for her, that means nothing has changed." "Do you wonder how Moiraine is treating Lan?" she asked sweetly, and had a moment of pleasure at the sharp jerk Nynaeve gave her braid. The pleasure faded quickly, though. Wounding remarks did not come naturally to her, and she knew Nynaeve's emotions concerning the warder were like skeins of yarn after a kitten had gotten into the knitting basket. But Lan was no kitten, and Nynaeve would have to do something about the man before his stubborn, stupid nobility made her mad enough to kill him. They were six altogether, all plainly dressed enough not to stand out in the villages and small towns they had encountered, yet perhaps as odd a party as had crossed the Carolane grass any time recently, four of them women, and one of the men in a litter slung between two horses. The litter horses carried light packs as well, with supplies for the long stretches between villages the way they had come. Six people, Egwene thought, and how many secrets? They all shared more than one, secrets that would have to be kept, perhaps, even in the White Tower. Life was simpler back home. "Nynaeve, do you think Rand is all right? And Perrin?" she added hastily. She could not afford to pretend any longer that one day she would marry Rand. Pretending would be all it was now. She did not like that. She was not entirely reconciled to it, but she knew it. "Your dreams? Have they been troubling you again?" Nynaeve sounded concerned, but Egwene was in no mood to accept sympathy. She made her voice sound as every day as she could manage. "From the rumors we heard, I can't tell what might be going on. They have everything I know about so twisted, so wrong." "Everything has been wrong since Moiraine came into our lives," Nynaeve said brusquely. "Perrin and Rand..." She hesitated, grimacing. Egwene thought Nynaeve believed everything that Rand had become was Moiraine's doing. "They will have to take care of themselves for now. I'm afraid we have something to worry about ourselves. Something is not right. I can feel it. Do you know what? Egwene asked. It feels almost like a storm. Nynaeve's dark blue eyes studied the morning sky, clear and blue, with only a few scattered white clouds, and she shook her head again. Like a storm coming. Nynaeve had always been able to foretell the weather. Listening to the wind, it was called, and the wisdom of every village was expected to do it, though many really could not. Yet since leaving Emmon's Field, Nynaeve's ability had grown, or changed. The storms, she felt, sometimes had to do with men rather than wind now. Egwene bit her underlip, thinking. They could not afford to be stopped or slowed, not after coming so far, not so close to Tar Valon. For Matt's sake, and for reasons that her mind might tell her were more important than the life of one village youth, one childhood friend, but that her heart could not rate so high. She looked at the others, wondering if any of them had noticed something. Verin Sedai, short and plump and all in shades of brown, rode apparently lost in thought, the hood of her cloak pulled forward till it all but hid her face, in the lead but letting her horse amble at its own pace. She was of the Brown Aja, and the Brown sisters usually cared more for seeking out knowledge than for anything in the world around them. Egwene was not so sure of Verin's detachment, though. Verin had put herself hip-deep in the affairs of the world by being with them. Elaine, of an age with Egwene and also a novice, but golden-haired and blue-eyed where Egwene was dark, rode back beside the litter where Matt lay unconscious. In the same gray as Egwene and Nynaeve, she was watching him with the worry they all felt. Matt had not roused in 3 days now. The lean, long-haired man riding on the other side of the litter seemed to be trying to look everywhere without anyone noticing, and the lines of his face had deepened in concentration. "Hurin," Egwene said, and Nynaeve nodded. They slowed to let the litter catch up to them. Verin ambled on ahead. "Do you sense something, Hurin?" Nynaeve asked. Elaine lifted her eyes, suddenly intent, from Matt's litter. With the three of them looking at him, the lean man shifted in his saddle and rubbed the side of his long nose. "Trouble," he said, curt and reluctant at the same time. "I think maybe trouble." A thief-taker for the King of Shinar, he did not wear a Shinaran warrior's topknot, yet the short sword and notched sword-breaker at his belt were worn with use. Years of experience seemed to have given him some talent at sniffing out wrongdoers, especially those who had done violence. Twice on the journey he had advised them to leave a village after being there less than an hour. The first time they had all refused, saying they were too tired, but before the night was done, the innkeeper and two other men of the village had tried to murder them in their beds. They were only simple thieves, not dark friends, just greedy for the horses and whatever they had in their saddlebags and bundles. But the rest of the village knew of it, and apparently considered strangers fair gleanings. They had been forced to flee a mob waving axe handles and pitchforks. The second time, Verin ordered them to ride on as soon as Hurin spoke. But the thief-taker was always wary when talking to any of his companions, except Matt, back when Matt could talk. The two of them had joked and played at dice when the women were not too close at hand. Egwene thought he might be uneasy at being alone for all practical purposes with an Aes Sedai and three women in training for sisterhood. Some men found facing a fight easier than facing Aes Sedai. "What kind of trouble?" Elaine said. She spoke easily, but with such a clear note of expecting to be answered immediately and in detail that Hurin opened his mouth. "I smell—" He cut himself short and blinked as if surprised, eyes darting from one woman to another. "Just a feeling," he said finally. A hunch. I've seen some tracks, yesterday and today. A lot of horses. 20 or 30 going this way, 20 or 30 that. It makes me wonder. That's all. A feeling. But I say it's trouble." "Tracks?" Egwene had not noticed them. Nynaeve said sharply, "I did not see anything worrisome in them." Nynaeve prided herself on being as good a tracker as any man. "They were days old. What makes you think they are trouble?"
"I just think they are," Hurin said slowly,
as if he wanted to say more. He dropped his eyes, rubbing at his nose and inhaling deeply. "It's been a long time since we saw a village," he muttered. "Who knows what news from Falma has come before us? We might not find so good a welcome as we expect. I'm thinking these men could be brigands, killers. We should be wary, I'm thinking. If Matt was on his feet, I'd scout ahead, but maybe it's best I don't leave you alone." Nynaeve's eyebrows lifted. "Do you believe we cannot look after ourselves?" "The One Power won't do you much good if somebody kills you before you can use it," Hurin said, addressing the tall pommel of his saddle. "Begging your pardon, but I think I'll just ride up with Varen Sedai for a time." He dug in his heels and galloped forward before any of them could speak again. "Now that is a surprise," Elaine said, as Hurin slowed a little distance from the brown sister. Varen did not seem to notice him any more than she noticed anything else, and he appeared content to leave it so. "He has been staying as far from Varen as he could ever since we left Toman Head. He always looks at her as if he's afraid of what she might say." "Respecting Aes Sedai doesn't mean he is not afraid of them," Nynaeve said, then added reluctantly, "of us." "If he thinks there might be trouble, we ought to send him out scouting." Egwene took a deep breath and gave the other two women as level a look as she could manage. "If there is trouble, we can defend ourselves better than he could with 100 soldiers to help him." "He doesn't know that," Nynaeve said flatly, "and I'm not about to tell him, or anyone else." "I can imagine what Varen would have to say about it," Elaine sounded anxious. "I wish I had some idea how much she does know. Egwene, I don't know if my mother could help me if the Amyrlin found out, much less help the pair of you, or even whether she would try." Elaine's mother was Queen of Andor. "She was only able to learn a little of the power before she left the White Tower, for all she has lived as if she had been raised to full sister." "We cannot hope to rely on Morghaeys," Nynaeve said. "She is in Camelin, and we will be in Tar Valon. No, we may be in enough trouble already for going off as we did, no matter what we've brought back. It will be best if we stay low, behave humbly, and do nothing to attract more attention than we already have." Another time, Egwene would have laughed at the idea of Nynaeve pretending to be humble. Even Elaine managed a better job of it. But at present she did not feel like laughing. "And if Hurin is right? If we are attacked? He cannot defend us against 20 or 30 men, and we might be dead if we wait for Varen to do something." "You said you sense a storm, Nynaeve." "You do?" Elaine said. Red-gold curls swung as she shook her head. "Varen will not like it if we..." She trailed off. "Whatever Varen likes or doesn't like, we may have to." "I will do what must be done," Nynaeve said sharply. "If there is anything to be done, and you two will run if need be. The White Tower may be all abuzz with your potential, but don't think they will not still you both if the Amyrlin seat or the hall of the tower decides it is necessary." Elaine swallowed hard. "If they would still us for it," she said in a faint voice, "they would still you, too. We should all run together, or act together. Hurin has been right before. If we want to live to be in trouble in the tower, we may have to do what we must." Egwene shivered. Stilled. Cut off from Saidar, the female half of the true source. Few Aes Sedai had ever incurred that penalty, yet there were deeds for which the tower demanded stilling. Novices were required to learn the names of every Aes Sedai who had ever been stilled, and their crimes. She could always feel the source there, now, just out of sight, like the sun at noon over her shoulder. If she often caught nothing when she tried to touch Saidar, she still wanted to touch it. The more she touched it, the more she wanted to, all the time, no matter what Shiriam Sedai, the mistress of novices, said about the dangers of growing too fond of the feel of the One Power. To be cut off from it, still able to sense Saidar, but never to touch it again. Neither of the others seemed to want to talk either. To cover her shaking, she bent from her saddle to the gently swaying litter. Matt's blankets had become disarrayed, exposing a curved dagger in a golden sheath clutched in one hand, a ruby the size of a pigeon's egg capping the hilt. Careful not to touch the dagger, she eased the blankets back over his hand. He was only a few years older than she, but gaunt cheeks and sallow skin had aged him. His chest barely moved as he breathed hoarsely. A lumpy leather sack lay at his feet. She shifted the blanket to cover that, too. "We have to get Matt to the tower," she thought. "And the sack." Nynaeve leaned down as well and felt Matt's forehead. "His fever is worse," she sounded worried. "If only I had some worry-not root or feverbane." "Perhaps if Varen tried healing again," Elaine said. Nynaeve shook her head. She smoothed Matt's hair back and sighed, then straightened before speaking. "She says it is all she can do to keep him alive now, and I believe her. I tried healing last night myself, but nothing happened." Elaine gasped. "Shiriam Sedai says we mustn't try to heal until we've been guided step by step 100 times. "You could have killed him," Egwene said sharply. Nynaeve sniffed loudly. "I was healing before I ever thought of going to Tar Valon, even if I didn't know I was. But it seems I need my medicines to make it work for me. If I only had some feverbane, I do not think he has much time left. Hours, maybe." Egwene thought she sounded almost as unhappy about knowing, about how she knew, as she did about Matt. She wondered again why Nynaeve had chosen to go to Tar Valon for training at all. She had learned to channel unknowingly, even if she could not always control the act, and had passed the crisis that killed 3 out of 4 women who learned without Aes Sedai guidance. Nynaeve said she wanted to learn more, but often she was as reluctant about it as a child being dosed with sheep's tongue root. "We will have him in the White Tower soon," Egwene said. "They can heal him there. The Amarlin will take care of him. She will take care of everything." She did not look at where Matt's blanket covered the sack at his feet. The other 2 women were studiously not looking at it either. There were some secrets they would all be relieved to shed. "Riders," Nynaeve said suddenly, but Egwene had already seen them. 2 dozen men appearing over a low rise ahead, white cloaks flapping as they galloped, angling toward them. "Children of the Light," Elaine said, like a curse. "I think we have found your storm and Hurin's trouble." Varen had pulled up, a hand on Hurin's arm to stop him drawing his sword. Egwene touched the lead litter horse to stop it just behind the plump Aes Sedai. "Let me do all the talking, children," the Aes Sedai said placidly, pushing her cowl back to reveal gray in her hair. Egwene was not sure how old Varen was. She thought old enough to be a grandmother, but the gray streaks were the Aes Sedai's only signs of age. "And whatever you do, do not allow them to make you angry." Varen's face was as calm as her voice, but Egwene thought she saw the Aes Sedai measuring the distance to Tar Valon. The tops of the towers were visible now, and a high bridge arching over the river to the island, tall enough for the trading ships that plied the river to sail beneath. "Close enough to see," Egwene thought, "but too far to do any good." For a moment she was sure the oncoming white cloaks meant to charge them, but their leader raised a hand and they abruptly drew rein a scant 40 paces off, scattering dust and dirt ahead of them. Nynaeve muttered angrily under her breath, and Elaine sat straight and full of pride, appearing likely to berate the white cloaks for ill manners. Hurin still had a grip on his sword hilt. He looked ready to put himself between the women and the white cloaks, no matter what Varen said. Varen mildly waved a hand in front of her face to dispel the dust. The white-cloaked riders spread out in an arc, blocking the way firmly. Their breastplates and conical helmets shone from polishing, and even the mail on their arms gleamed brightly. Each man had the flaring golden sun on his breast. Some fitted arrows to bows, which they did not raise but held ready. Their leader was a young man, yet he wore 2 golden knots of rank beneath the sunburst on his cloak.
2 Tar Valon witches, unless I miss my guess, yes?" he said with a tight smile that pinched his narrow face. Arrogance brightened his eyes, as if he knew some truth others were too stupid to see. and two nits and a pair of lapdogs, one sick and one old. Huron bristled, but Varen's hand restrained him. "Where do you come from?" the white cloak demanded.
"We come from the west," Varen said placidly. "Move out of our way and let us continue. The Children of the Light have no authority here."
"The children have authority wherever the light is, witch, and where the light is not, we bring it. Answer my questions, or must I take you to our camp and let the questioners ask?"
Matt could not afford any more delay in reaching help in the White Tower. And more importantly, Egwene winced to think of it that way, more importantly, they could not let the contents of that sack fall into White Cloak hands.
"I have answered you," Varen said, still calm, "and more politely than you deserve. Do you really believe you can stop us?"
Some of the White Cloaks raised their bows as if she had uttered a threat, but she went on, her voice never rising.
"In some lands you may hold sway by your threats, but not here, in sight of Tar Valon. Can you truly believe that in this place you will be allowed to carry off Aes Sedai?"
The officer shifted uneasily in his saddle, as though suddenly doubting whether he could back up his words. Then he glanced back at his men, either to remind himself of their support or because he had remembered they were watching, and with that he took himself in hand.
"I have no fear of your dark friend ways, witch. Answer me or answer the questioners."
He did not sound as forceful as he had. Varen opened her mouth as if for idle conversation, but before she could speak, Elaine jumped in, voice ringing with command.
"I am Elaine, daughter heir of Andor. If you do not move aside at once, you will have Queen Morghese to answer to, White Cloak."
Varen hissed with vexation. The White Cloak looked taken aback for an instant, but then he laughed.
"You think it so, yes? Perhaps you will discover Morghese no longer has so much love for witches, girl. If I take you from them and return you to her side, she will thank me for it. Lord Captain Aemon Valda would like very much to speak to you, daughter heir of Andor."
He raised a hand, whether to gesture or signal his men, Egwene could not say. Some of the White Cloaks gathered their reins.
"There's no more time to wait," Egwene thought. "I will not be chained again."
She opened herself to the One Power. It was a simple exercise, and after long practice it went much more swiftly than the first time she had tried. In a heartbeat, her mind emptied of everything, everything but a single rosebud floating in emptiness. She was the rosebud opening to the light, opening to Saidar, the female half of the true source. The power flooded her, threatening to sweep her away. It was like being filled with light, with the light, like being one with the light, a glorious ecstasy. She fought to keep from being overwhelmed and focused on the ground in front of the White Cloak officer's horse, a small patch of ground. She did not want to kill anyone.
"You will not take me."
The man's hand was still going up. With a roar, the ground in front of him erupted in a narrow fountain of dirt and rocks higher than his head. Screaming, his horse reared, and he rolled out of his saddle like a sack. Before he hit the ground, Egwene shifted her focus closer to the other White Cloaks, and the ground threw up another small explosion. Bella danced sideways, but she controlled the mare with reins and knees without even thinking of it. Wrapped inside emptiness, she was still surprised at a third eruption, not of her making, and a fourth. Distantly, she was aware of Nynaeve and Elaine, both enveloped in the glow that said they, too, had embraced Saidar, had been embraced by it. That aura would not be visible to any but another woman who could channel, but the results were visible to all. Explosions harried the White Cloaks on every side, showering them with dirt, shaking them with noise, sending their horses plunging wildly. Huron stared around him, mouth open and obviously as frightened as the White Cloaks, as he tried to keep the litter horses and his own mount from bolting. Varen was wide-eyed with astonishment and anger. Her mouth worked furiously, but whatever she might be saying was lost in the thunder. And then the White Cloaks were running away, some dropping their bows in panic, galloping as if the Dark One himself were at their backs. All but the young officer, who was picking himself up off the ground. Shoulders hunched, he stared at Varen, the whites of his eyes showing all the way round. Dust stained his fine white cloak and his face, but he did not seem to notice.
"Kill me, then, witch," he said shakily. "Go ahead, kill me as you killed my father."
The Aes Sedai ignored him. Her attention was all on her companions. As if they, too, had forgotten their officer, the fleeing white cloaks vanished over the same rise where they had first appeared, all in a body and none looking back. The officer's horse ran with them. Under Varen's furious gaze, Egwene let go of Saidar slowly, unwillingly. It was always hard, letting go. Even more slowly, the glow around Nynaeve vanished. Nynaeve was frowning hard at the pinch-faced white cloak before them, as if he might still be capable of some sort of trickery. Elaine looked shocked by what she had done.
"What do you have done?" Varen began, then stopped to take a deep breath. Her stare took in all three of the younger women. "What you have done is an abomination. An abomination! An Aes Sedai does not use the power as a weapon except against Shadow Spawn, or in the last extreme to defend her life. The three oaths, they were ready to kill us," Nynaeve broke in heatedly. "Kill us or carry us off to be tortured. He was giving the order."
It was not really using the power as a weapon, Varen Sedai.
Elaine held her chin high, but her voice shook.
"We did not hurt anyone, or even try to hurt anyone. Surely
do not split hairs with me," Varen snapped. "When you become full Aes Sedai, if you ever become full Aes Sedai, you will be bound to obey the three oaths, but even novices are expected to do their best to live as if already bound."
"What about him?" Nynaeve gestured to the white cloak officer, still standing there and looking stunned. Her face was as tight as a drum. She seemed almost as angry as the Aes Sedai.
"He was about to take us prisoner. Matt will die if he doesn't reach the tower soon, and...
Egwene knew what Nynaeve was struggling not to say aloud.
"And we can't let that sack fall into any hands but the Ammerlin's."
Varen regarded the white cloak wearily.
"He was only trying to bully us, child. He knew very well he could not make us go where we did not want, not without more trouble than he was willing to accept. Not here, not in sight of Tar Valon. I could have talked us past him, with a little time and a little patience. Oh, he might well have tried to kill us if he could have done it from hiding, but no white cloak with the brains of a goat will try harming an Aes Sedai who knows he is there. See what you have done. What stories will those men tell, and what harm will it do?"
The officer's face had reddened when she mentioned hiding.
"It is no cowardice not to charge the powers that broke the world," he burst out. "You witches want to break the world again in the service of the Dark One."
Varen shook her head in tired disbelief. Egwene wished she could mend some of the damage she had done.
"I am very sorry for what I did," she told the officer. She was glad she was not bound to speak no word that was not true as full Aes Sedai were, because what she had said was only half true at best.
"I should not have, and I apologize. I'm sure Varen Sedai will heal your bruises."
He stepped back as if she had offered to have him skinned alive, and Varen sniffed loudly.
"We have come a long way," Egwene went on. "All the way from Toman Head, and if I weren't so tired, I would never have..."
"Be quiet, girl!"
Varen shouted at the same time the white cloak snarled.
"Toman Head? Falma? You were at Falma?"
He stumbled back another step and half drew his sword. From the look on his face, Egwene did not know whether he meant to attack or to defend himself. Huron moved his horse closer to the white cloak, a hand on his sword breaker, but the narrow-faced man went on in a rant, spittle flying with his fury.
"My father died at Falma. Bayar told me. You witches killed him for your false dragon. I'll see you dead for it. I will see you burn."
"Impetuous children," Varen sighed. "Almost as bad as boys for letting your mouths run away with you." "Go with the light, my son," she told the white cloak.
Without another word, she guided them around the man, but his shouts followed after.
"My name is Dane Bornhald. Remember it, dark friends. I will make you fear my name. Remember my name.
As Bornhold's shouts faded behind them, they rode in.